Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
All right, folks, call is going to begin here in just a moment. All right. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law, brought to you by Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you're on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everybody in no uncertain terms that anybody looking for legal advice has no place or business here on any of these calls. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Now, should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be to get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. They're just folks saying what they might do where they similarly situated. It's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. Go over a couple things here very quick with Your Remedy. First of all, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, at www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page that comes up. It's got just two items on it, and an otherwise blank page. But these two items are of much importance, especially if this is all new to you. On the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American Jurisprudence, or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have, well, at least a basic concept of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you may find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, primarily known for its very high win rate in traffic scenarios throughout the country. That's what it's most commonly acquired for anyway. But that's not really why it's up here. The reason why it's up here is once you've gone through the jurisdictionary and you start the common law default process, you'll see very quickly that it acts as like a real-life homework assignment, a very easy-to-use, lines-up-perfectly homework assignment for the jurisdictionary course. And, of course, with it being such a high win rate, and then, of course, with traffic scenarios, for most folks anyway, traffic court scenarios are usually a lesser importance. They're not as dire. You know, if something goes wrong with it, worst-case scenario, you know, you have a small citation to, you know, to pay or something like that. And so it we find that folks are much more likely to dip their toe in the water, if you will, with trying out the common law default process. And again, it lines up perfectly with the jurisdictionary. So you study the jurisdictionary course, then you exercise the common law default, and you've got yourself a very nice educational process there. Now, of course, both of them are very, very reasonably priced, with the contribution request of $250 for the jurisdictionary and $150 for the common law default. And so it's just a great place to start, and we hope that you'll pick that up at your earliest convenience. All right, also on the subject of your remedy is in the law, you're probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of your remedy, you're met with that little blue box that pops up, asks you if you want to continue on to the website that you requested or stop for a moment and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are many different information providers at your remedies in the law, talking about many different subjects. And then all of that, all of your remedies in the law, is just one of a dozen or so websites that altogether makes up the umbrella that is Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a lot for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that. If you have any questions about whether we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, you can always email me, mm@yourremedyisinthelaw.com, or you can call the 1-800 number, 1-800-625-4250, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that you can. You call the 1-800 number, make sure you leave a good detailed message there with your name and best contact number, and what it is, the topic that you're wanting to discuss. All right, next up, just a moment here, talk about Grass Fire Communications, formerly known as Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends, tell your family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every website that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables you to speak with one another on a very local level based on a pre-decided topic of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. You've got a very easy setup. A startup wizard, put your name in here, click next, put your address in here, click next, that sort of thing. By the time it's done, it will have asked you to pick from a long list of interests what your interests are. Of course, you can pick multiple interests. And these interests could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, veterans' rights, on and on and on. If you can think of it, you'll find it in that list. And whatever it is that intrigues you, really. And then, of course, it'll ask you at some point, what radius do you want to choose? How far away from home do you want to venture? And by the time it's all done, when it's all said and done, it will set you up there with folks that are right there in your local area that share the same interests that you do. And the purpose of this, of course, is for you to meet with one another and discuss various matters, various educational processes and learn how to educate yourself. So let's say, you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes in and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that's fair. I don't think they should be able to do that. Well, as truthful as that might be, as accurate as that might be, I don't know how much that's going to actually help you, in a real life scenario. But maybe the next person comes in and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd go down to my local courthouse. If you don't know, every town's got a local courthouse there with a little law library. And I'd go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. And then I'd go on YouTube and watch this particular educational video on a particular matter. Well, now we're starting to get somewhere. Now you're starting to actually have something that's going to impact your situation. And maybe the next person comes in after that and says, oh, that sounds like a great idea. But on top of that, I'd go to this particular website and buy this educational course. And I'd go over here and look this up and that and the other. And now, before you know it, now you're really making headway. Now you're really making progress in your situation. And that's all we're trying to do here at your remedies in the law, is just get folks to start learning, you know, open up, speak with one another, remove the, you know, the fear that comes from even discussing certain topics. And that's the purpose of Grass Fire Communications. Of course, there's no cost to you for Grass Fire Communications, either the signing up or the using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Also, we've got Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, maybe you haven't had a chance to pick up a membership at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Of course, we do encourage you to do that as well at your earliest convenience. Membership at Your Remedy Is in the Law is, again, a very generous request of a simple contribution of $10 a month. And that gives you full access to everything that we've got at Your Remedy. But if that's not an option for you yet, you've got Freedoms Radio. Every call is broadcasted out over the air, completely free of charge. Freedoms Radio, in and of itself, is completely free of charge. So you don't ever miss a call again if you don't wish. If you want to listen to any particular night's call, you just go to freedomsradio.com and play button. Now, of course, if you're wanting to check out some of the older calls that we've had, there's just a wealth of information there, education there to be had. That's part of what you get there. That's for that $10 monthly contribution for your membership at Your Remedy Is in the Law, because now you have access to the archives. You can go back and listen to any of the calls that we've had since day one. And I don't have to tell you, there's just so many there. You could listen for months on end and not repeat a single bit of information. So check that out when you get a chance as well. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is called your caveat emptor, your buyer beware. Your Remedy Is in the Law is, of course, under the umbrella of Americans Restoring America. And when you come aboard, you go with an information provider. You're doing just that. Information providers pay for advertising at Your Remedy Is in the Law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider, along with any other expenses that info provider might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your situation, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own, just simply because they can't be found. They've set it up to where they can't be found. And we make the introductions. Now, not all teaching efforts by the information providers is always guaranteed to be successful. Everybody hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But things in life sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to wrestle with them and deal with them as you do with anything else in life. Again, we do want to emphasize, though, that the plan is always to be successful. If you have any questions about that, we encourage you to check out yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these particular products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at Your Remedy Is in the Law, anyway. When you call in again, you're going with a particular information provider. So any discussion of a refund or credit, partial credit, any of the above, would be a strict and private matter between you and that particular information provider. But even then, I can tell you folks, that's very few and far between. Must be extenuating circumstances. You're always expected, again, to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly here, pertaining to all the info providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we want to remind everybody that all of these speakers at these conference calls are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always remain civil. Besides, if the question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it. All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call over this time to Mr. Edward, and he will introduce our speaker, Mr. Slevin, for this evening and what we can expect to talk about.
Hey, thank you so very much, Martin. I appreciate that. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to speak tonight and address the issue of how to navigate with businesses that have routines and customs that they are comfortable working with without having to get into bizarre arrangements in order to protect our money that we've earned in exchange for our labor. It's very simple. LLC, limited liability company. And why is this not something being used elsewhere or all the time? Well, it is, but however, the ones that are using it are usually the entrepreneurs, and they're the ones that are working their accountants to death to minimize their tax footprint that they have, or their tax liability that they have with the Internal Revenue Service. Well, what if I told you that a very unique, uniquely crafted LLC has been brought together where it does not have a taxable responsibility? That's what you're going to hear about tonight. And uniquely, it's not just for other businesses, entrepreneurs. It's for employees. Employees is a unique word. It's a legal term, word of art, that references something that only occurs within a certain jurisdiction. There's a difference between an employee and a worker. They both get paid, but it's grossly different. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin. Go ahead, buddy.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. So one of the main questions that vexes Americans is just who in the hell is liable for the income tax? Well, there's these things out there called the rules of statutory construction. And when they're used, they are typically used to confuse people rather than explain things simple. Well, one of these things, one of these rules says that you have, when defining a term, which is a word or phrase, defined it into a new term in the legislation, that definition is what has to be used when reading and or applying the statute. Another rule says that when defining a term with a list of things included in the term, they must remain within the same family. Okay, so an example like the quote, the term eatables includes an apple, a banana, a grape, a rock, and a chicken, end quote. Well, obviously, rock is not of the same class, and therefore that would be an invalid definition. So if we look to the Internal Revenue Code, or IRC, which is Title 26 of the United States Code, and its regulations, we go all the way down about 3 million words to a place called 7701 Definitions. A, when used in this title, were not otherwise distinctly expressed or manifestly incompatible with the intent thereof. Don't you love that? One, person. The term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, estate, partnership, association, company, or corporation, end quote. Now, note that word individual. It seems to be out of place, right? Well, it's not a thing. It is a delimiter. It means one of something. But what? A spotted lizard. A corporate individual. A one-eyed jack. Or could it be the term individual as is defined in Black's Law 6th edition, which says an individual is existing as an indivisible entity? Now, if you take that definition, well, then that makes sense. That falls in the same thing as trust, partnership, company, and so forth. So as we move on, 701A2 reads in part, the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. Now, unincorporated organization is the distinct definition of a limited liability company. And these things were first formed or first legislated about 1977, and they are a combination of the corporations and partnerships, which have been around for millennia. And then they changed up some of the wording so that people, when they read the verbiage, they would know that they were talking about a limited liability company versus a partnership or a corporation. Okay, so as we look at the above definitions, then we go down to back toward the front of the Internal Revenue Code, to Section 701, and it says, quote, a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. Second sentence, persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for income tax only in their separate or individual capacities. Well, it says the partnership, which we saw earlier, includes an unincorporated organization, shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. Can't be more distinct than that. So that's what you want to be. You want to be working under the name of a limited liability company. Because in all of the different forms of business, you, the man or woman, is not the LLC or the corporation. They are a separate and distinct legal identity from its members and or management. You work under the name of the LLC or corporation or whatever. So you, the man or woman, are working under the name or doing business under the name of these entities. On that second sentence, we see this is probably the most succinct one as far as going back to the 1909 and 1910 original first post 16th Amendment income tax laws. And it simply says that the persons carrying on business as partners, that doesn't really matter, but persons carrying on business shall be liable for the income tax. So the subject of the income tax is carrying on business in the corporate capacity, and the measure is the income on which the income tax is laid. Don't you like that word salad? So that's the basis of it. What you want to have is you want to have a limited liability company to work under that gives you full protection and absolute immunity, not exemption, immunity from the income tax. So how do we go about getting that into the hands of the people? Our company makes contract, and let me state this right now. All business is contract, and all contract is negotiation. Make a note of that. All business is contract, and all contract is negotiation. So our company negotiates with a man or woman and says, hey, what would you like your limited liability company to be named? And they come up with an idea. We hash it out, make sure it's usable. And then one of our people goes to the state of New Mexico and organizes a limited liability company by application. That is called the Articles of Organization. On the Articles of Organization in New Mexico, it requires a minimum of two parties. They're known as the organizer and the registered agent, both of which can be other LLCs. Now think about that for a moment. You got one LLC that is owned by another LLC that's owned by another LLC. All this is on the Secretary of State of New Mexico's public record, which is what most people can see. And so do you see any way of finding out that our man or woman can negotiated with our company to own one of these LLCs? Really, really hard to find. So the registered agent is their only job is to sit there and wait to receive process, which process would be if the LLC was sued and the court papers were then served on the LLC. The registered agent accepts those and then forwards them to the proper parties. So unlike places like Delaware and Nevada, possibly Wyoming, when you go to organize or incorporate in those states, they still require people's names, it's called the nominee list, to be put into the record. Now, they protect that list, but in New Mexico, it doesn't even exist. That's really cool. And I'm pretty sure the legislators got paid a whole lot of money to do that, because normally politicians don't give away the farm in such a fashion. So New Mexico then provides a certificate organization for this new company to our company who our people who applied for it. And then one of our workers who has never filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return and therefore is without the jurisdiction of the IRS goes down to the IRS website and files for a tax identification number known as an employer identification number or EIN for this new company. And so there's a number of questions when going to do that. One of them is, why is the LLC requesting an EIN? And there's about five answers listed. And the middle one is one we always use, and it says, for banking purposes. And the subheader says, select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly to satisfy banking requirements or local law. Do you hear anything in there about taxation? Nope, because the section is 701. The LLC is not subject to the income tax. So, upon receiving the EIN, that individual worker which made the application to the IRS is known as the sole member of this new company at that point in time. They hold a meeting of the membership, and then in the meeting they make a resolution, the company makes a resolution commissioning a third party as a manager for the LLC. Now, manager is the only officer known to an LLC. Corporations have president, CFO, directors, and such. Partnerships have limited partners, general partners, but the LLC only has manager. Now, you can put whatever you want in front of that, chief executive or bottle washer or whatever, but manager is the officer. So the ownership of the company, the limited liability company, is vested in the members, and that's why you've heard that term several times already. So the sole member has this and commissions a manager and brings all this back to the office. And the manager takes those three sheets of paper, the certificate of organization, the EIN paperwork, and his commission, otherwise known as a letter of authority, goes down to a brick-and-mortar bank and gets the new company a checking account. Comes with a debit card, which only has the company name on it and the title manager. And it has all the electronic bells and whistles available today in most banks. Once that's accomplished, it's all brought back to our office, and one of our other personnel brings up a pay-as-you-go cell phone. Here again, if I haven't mentioned it before, everything we do is for the client's anonymity and privacy. So the only thing seeing on the public record is our people's names and numbers. The client is never there. So this pay-as-you-go cell phone is programmed with the electronic banking, Square app, Cash app. Now, Square is a point of sale, so the new company can take payment for its products or services in debit card and credit card. And now you can get a debit card under the Square app, which forms another checking account for the company. And you can also, the company then can receive checks through the pay-as-you-go cell phone via Square app. Cash app is a point of sale is a peer-to-peer platform where you can move money back and forth really nice, quick, and easy. It also can get you a debit card and another checking account. So once this is all fleshed out, the new company has three separate checking accounts, debit cards, and so forth. So if something happens to one of them, you've got backup. As we say in the military, when you're planning, one is none and two is one. So you always carry a spare tire, a spare parachute, or a spare checking account. So once all this is done, we make sure everything works, and we ship it. We put it in a box, ship it to the client. Once that client opens up this business in a box, literally, then they become equipped to carry on business worldwide and income tax free. Sound pretty good? So that initially, when it's in the client's hands, is a small business. Yeah, these can be linked together in a complex situation. I like to use the one where you have a dentist, and the dentist has a practice. The practice is owned by one LLC, and it has a checking account. The equipment, chairs, drills, and stuff that the dentist uses in his practice are owned by a second LLC, and they rent it back to the practice. The building in which the office is, the work is done, is owned by a third LLC, and it is rented back to the practice. The fourth LLC would own or would be the controller of the workers, like the hygienist and the front office people and so forth. And each of them could have one of our LLCs, and we call our product a private firm. And the the private firm would then, the private firm could also be as part of the, each of the of the hygienist and things, and so that they would work under the umbrella, which was income tax free as well. So that would be one way of hooking these all together. And what that does is it renders the dentist judgment proof. So if he, if the practice were sued, he would have malpractice insurance. And then if the suit allowed them to get a judgment against the practice, then they would be able to thwart any kind of collection because all of the assets are, owned by other entities. Another thing that the, our private firm provides for is estate planning. So normally, you know, mom and pop have a house, a boat, and a car. And so as they get older, they want to give it to the kids or the beneficiaries. And so they write a will. And then the will has to go through probate and get taxed. So if mom and pop put all of their assets into a private firm, and then they would just, the beneficiaries would be issued a letter of authority to do business under the company name and instructions of how to carry on the business so that the mom and pop incapacitation at whatever level, the kids, aka beneficiaries, just go open up a safe, pull out their paperwork, and the business continues on because we set these up in perpetuity so the LLC itself can never die and it just moves on seamlessly, no estate tax, no probate. As I said in the dentist thing, the your basic W-2 situation right now where you have employer and employee, which are all defined terms within the Internal Revenue Code, that's a contract. Contracts are negotiable. So you can substitute in a private firm, a.k.a. a limited liability company, for the employee. And so the new situation would be one company contracting with a second company for the services of the man or woman, which if you've ever worked for a temp agency, that's exactly how they do it, except they charge income tax. And this situation would not. So that's a real quick and dirty on how we do what we do. What are your questions? Is anybody out there?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, I have to hit the... or if I hit the unmute button twice, then I've just...
I've done that.
Star 2 on your keypad, folks, if you have a question. Star 2 to raise your hand, or if you're listening on Freedoms Radio, type your question in the question bar, and do not forget to click submit, or we won't see it. Mr. Murphy, Nevada, go ahead, sir.
Yes, LLC, a corporation has to pay a fee every year, don't they? Does an LLC pay a fee too or not?
Okay, there are, in most states of the union, you are correct. In New Mexico, there is no fee. There is a registered agent compensation, but we figure that into our pricing. In fact, we have a sister company within our organization that actually acts as a registered agent. We've got one office down in Alamogordo, New Mexico, where the organizer sits, and the other in Raton, New Mexico, where the registered agent sits. So those typically annual fees and or reporting that you know about from the other states of the union do not exist for LLCs in New Mexico. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
All right. Any other questions, folks? Star 2 on your keypad. We're going to have a very, very short call. We don't pick up some speed here. I know that will break Mr. Slum's heart.
While they're thinking about it, well, let's, I know one question that was asked in the same vein as the earlier gentleman tonight about the 1065 that typical LLCs have to fill out and give to the IRS every year. That does not happen with our product because we rely on Section 701, which says LLC is not subject to the income tax. And not subject to equals not liable for equals immune. And the difference between immune and exempt in tax law means that the if somebody is exempt, it means that you meet the qualifications for the tax, but the legislators in their largesse has not has decided to exempt you from the penalty. The word immune means that you do not meet qualifications to be taxed, which is the same as not liable for or not subject to. So that is the key to all of this. Anybody out there?
Yep, Edward in Georgia. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a CRT, a trust, and everything. And if I get these LLCs, would I need to get one LLC for each trust?
No, the trust would set into the place of a member of the limited liability company. So that would be a double blind, if you will. Our LLCs, if you go down to a local bank and say, hey, look, I want to get a checking account for my trust, they're probably going to look at you sideways because there's a lot of disinformation about trust, and there's a lot of people that have used them for nefarious deals and stuff. It's a little bit complicated. But everybody in the business world knows exactly what a limited liability company is and how it works. So we've taken to calling our product, the private firm, a commercial interface for the CRTs and so forth. But the technical thing is that the CRTs would be, if you used had both of them, each would be a 50% membership owner of the limited liability company, which makes up our product called the private firm. Answer your question?
Yeah, so you saying that each trust would then be a 50% owner in it?
That's one way of setting it up. These things are, we can set it up just any way you want to do it, but the best way of saying what it really does, using the trust as members, being members, is it's a commercial interface between the trust and the banks or the phone company or whoever else is out there it wants to do business with.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, if I may just add to that or springboard off of it, the reason to bring in two CRTs as the each having 50% share is because ultimately you'll be segueing Mr. Slevin's LLC into what we call the Golden Horseshoe. And the Golden Horseshoe you'll find at theultimateinassetprotection.com. Underneath the header on the far right corner, you'll see a icon of a horseshoe, and it's golden. Click it. You'll see PowerPoint presentations. There's 10, 11, 12 of them there that walk you through that process. So when you are walking through that process of the Golden Horseshoe and it says create the LLC, this has already been created because you bought Mr. Slevin's LLC, and that's what's being brought in. If you haven't done that yet, then that's what is going to be brought in will be Mr. Slevin's LLC rather than the LLC that we had prepared before we had met Mr. Slevin and the services that he offers. I hope that further adds clarity.
Okay. I believe it did.
All right. Good deal. All right. Star 2 on your keypad, folks. If you have a question, star 2 to raise your hand. or type it in on the Freedoms Radio side. If not, then we will wrap it up.
What's really interesting while we're thinking about this is thinking about populating is that if you work for somebody, you're an employee at Publix or whatever, Mr. Slevin offers a service where he will actually have dialogue directly with your employer, showing them how they can save, what was the percentage, 50% or 25%?
Roughly, the labor cost of an employer for its employee is usually about 1.6 times the salary of the employee. And so when you go through all the numbers, and by doing it with our private firm, interposed between the employer and the employee, then the employer saves roughly 25% on their cost, and the employee, a former employee, gets about a 20% raise to their bottom line.
Yeah, so it's an exciting tool to work with, and it's one that I wish had been available to me when back in the day when I was an employee for Brazil Corporation. So back to you, Martin.
All right, thank you. All right, Smurfy again there in Nevada. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, that was 7701 was the definition of an employee.
Yeah, 7701A20 is the definition, is one of the definitions of employee. There are several, but that's the main one for the entire title, United States Code 26, Title 26, United States Code. And the that's a real interesting one to read. 7701A20, it's about 110 words down. It says the term employee includes the a full-time life insurance salesman. So for all of you out there that thought you were employees all your life, unless you're, work for Prudential or somebody like that.
Nobody ever reads any of the code. That's the problem.
Well, I'm nobody, and I've read this stuff, and I've probably got two PhDs studying what's called the statutes at large, which is what Congress originally wrote down back throughout the last century, and then it was transmuted from the original statutes to the United States Code, and when they do that, they have poetic license, if you will, to make it even more confusing.
From what I've studied, there is nowhere in legislative history that the Congress instituted the Internal Revenue Service. Cannot be found.
Yeah, there was a thing called the Bureau of Internal Revenue back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And I believe it was 1953 that the name got changed to Internal Revenue Service. But there was no – and then of course, we have evidence that the headquarters of the Internal Revenue Service is actually in Puerto Rico. And we could talk about that kind of stuff all night long.
We had stallions that used to service our mares. Is that the same thing?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
You have to ask a question. The appellation is Internal Revenue Service, yet it appears to go national. It's
appears to go international.
Service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Sure. So what is it
internal to? Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17?
The bottom line is District of Columbia and its territories. It's property, which places
Article
like
one,
Guam.
Section 8, Clause 17?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
But since we've all, quote unquote, become slaves of D.C. and America today, then that internal can reach out to any of the slaves of D.C. Unless you go out and get your status changed, which is highly recommended. Get back to the we the people sovereignty as spoke of in Chisholm v. George.
Yeah. Get your status corrected.
Yes.
It was barred the day you were born.
Yep.
Anything else, Mr. Murphy?
Oh, no, that's it. I was just thinking about stuff, but yeah, it's definitely the route to go.
I totally agree.
And the employers will love it because, like you said, they deal with LLCs. So I had to jump through hoops this last train and rigging finally came around. Each employer's, you just have to work with them to get them to accept a W-8 bin. So.
Mm-hmm. It's all about negotiation.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, star 2 on your keypad, folks. Do we have any other questions? Or type it in on the Freedoms Radio side. I think that it might do her. Yeah, I think that's going to do it.
Well, y'all have a great sun party day and lift the green beer for me. Do you hear her?
We're orange on St. Patrick's Day, folks. I'm a Scotsman, eh? All right.
Nice.
Look forward to thank you all for joining us this evening. Look forward to seeing you Saturday night. Also, tomorrow night, if you have never heard the call, it is a recorded call. Join us tomorrow night. You can if you want. Nobody will ask you to speak because it's a recorded call. But it'll give you something to listen to, something to talk about. And if you have any questions and want to pursue other questions, just don't hesitate to call Martin at 1-800-625-4250, and he'll route you to the appropriate information provider to talk with, speak to. Thank you. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.